alone down in New Orleans on the winds of despair, where music and laughter once filled the air. Got a graveyard and ghosts, politicians stand in the city.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another world edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by our listeners, supporting community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. That was Dr. John, the song "The City That Care Forgot." That's right. This is this week is the 10th anniversary of the national disaster that was Hurricane Katrina, and it wasn't a natural disaster per se. It was a national disaster that was compounded and basically increased exponentially by the actions of our own government. So we're going to be talking a little bit about that in the show. But in the meantime, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. This hour is also brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employee Organization Union, the GEO at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. Okay, we got quite a show today. Besides talking about the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, we also have a caller calling in at half past the hour, 11:30. Chris Caney is going to be talking about how the recent legalization of marijuana in Colorado and Washington has changed the laws in regards to DUIs, workplace drug testing, and other such things. So he'll be calling in. And first, we're going to start out, though, with some news stories, because lots been happening this week. Bob, would you like to go first?
Sure. In a decision that came down on Thursday from the National Labor Relations Board, it says it could greatly improve prospects for workers to form unions in a fast-growing and largely low-wage swath of the U.S. workforce. The NLRB redefined the standards of determining when more than one firm will be considered joint employers of a group of workers. So it says this new standard is largely a return to a broader, more inclusive definition used before the Reagan era. NLRB tightened the rules, thus narrowing the number of businesses operations considered to have joint employers of a particular group of workers. So it says this is important in cases like the one just decided by the NLRB, which enforces the National Labor Relations Act. It concerned a 2014 vote on whether 240 workers could form a Teamsters union local at a recycling plant in California. A company called Browning Ferris, a waste disposal giant that employed 60 workers operating inside the recycling facility and 240 more inside, owned the building but subcontracted the provision and direct management of its workers to a small firm, Lead Point. So, yeah.
Lead Point.
Yeah. Lead Point.
Oh, Lead Point. Okay.
You know, I don't know. It says that the conservative Republicans on the board were vehemently opposed to this. They're going to take it to Congress and possibly as far as the Supreme Court. So this could have a lot of implications for franchisees and stuff like that, or, you know, McDonald's for years has been saying that they are not the employers of the people working in there, that the franchisees are actually the employers.
Mm-hmm.
But in these instances now, they're going to be able to hold McDonald's as responsible because they'll be referred to as what they're calling joint employers.
Oh, good. Okay.
So we'll see where this goes. Like I say, the Republicans are threatening to take this all the way to the Supreme Court. They say that almost 2.9 million Americans had jobs through temporary agencies in 2014. That's 2% of the workforce. And so there's quite a few people out there that may be involved in these kind of situations. And we've known for years that some of these huge corporations, Walmart and stuff like that, have been hiding behind the fact saying that we're not the direct employers of these people.
Yeah.
So we'll see where this goes. I mean, it's good news for the workers if it continues through on this path.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Gus?
We got to rally around that.
Indeed.
That's going to be a huge, huge thing going forward.
Yeah.
Outside of that, there's been a lot of talk about the things going on with the police violence. And as we can see, history is repeating itself because we have some surveillance tactics being used by officials or this police state. A report published last week in Glenn Greenwald's Intercept has revealed that police spied and exchanged information on activists who led protests against police violence last winter in New York City. The spying was conducted by a special counterterrorism squad from police working for the New York Metropolitan Transit Authority and the intelligence division of the New York Police Department. That everybody knows that famous NYPD, the one that has had corruption problems since its foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Are we really surprised that they are now spying on people who lead both peaceful and counter hegemonic protests against the system? The protests erupted after the refusal of a grand jury to indict NYPD officer Daniel Pataleo for the murder of Eric Garner. Pataleo was videotaped, and everybody has seen this, strangling Garner during a target arrest for allegedly selling tax-free cigarettes in the borough of Staten Island on July 17th last year.
Oh, man, what a dangerous criminal.
I know,
oh,
right?
Wow. Wow.
Film. Yeah. I mean, we have an actual videotaped lynching that went viral internationally. Everybody's seen it. So what happened was activists obtained 118 pages of police reports from the MTA and 161 pages from the Metro North Railroad through New York's Freedom of Information Law. The documents cover protests that took place from December 2014 to February 2015 in Grand Central Station in Manhattan, where the MTA police have jurisdiction. A number of protests in the timeline occurred there. So the NYPD has not released any documents, but those that have been supplied reveal an information exchange between the NYPD and the MTA police and the presence of both NYPD and MTA undercover officers at the protests. So you have these police tracking these demonstrators and these activists, and we know that they have case files open on them. These are the same tactics that were used against groups going back to the 1930s during the increase of Red Scare tactic and people equating people fighting for civil rights or just human rights with the communist scare at the time. And so they have just documents and documents of all these different ground level leaders and just infiltrating the organizations and things like that. So history is repeating itself. This is not something new.
There's been countless lawsuits on this over the decades that have won. Yet this stuff continues.
It continues.
You know, it dies down for a little bit and it comes right back. But I mean, I know there was lawsuits from the 60s and 70s against COINTELPRO, which won in the courts, and I mean, huge amounts of money awarded in damages. Then in the 1980s, when the FBI and other groups, including Army Intelligence, were infiltrating and spying on the Central American Solidarity groups, and you know, up until like Occupy is another example.
Let's get a little deeper into it. What exactly does this mean? What are the stakes of the fact that this is continuing to happen over time? Although we've had victories against this, the system is saying that we don't care what you all do individually. As a structure, we are going to do what we want.
Yep,
and we are going to maintain a particular type of status quo in power over that group. It doesn't matter if you win a court victory here, there. Those are individual victories that don't go into the foundational problem.
Yes.
You may get some money here and you may get this and that, but we still have the structure of that, of this foundational racist and exploitative practices of surveillance, and we're going to continue to do that. I mean, it's built into the Constitution. We can go all the way back to the Alien and Sedition Acts. I mean, so much surveillance and restriction of this so-called freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is point blank period. Fascism.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascism with a smiley face. We're a democracy. Of course we are. Yeah, right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, on the surface it is, but you dig, you scratch just a little bit below, you know, on the surface, and it's very ugly. Very ugly society here we have. I mean, as far as our prison systems, I mean, they're like third world conditions. I mean, compared to, say, Europe, Europe.
You see some of the prisons in like Sweden and Switzerland. They look like hotel accommodations, like you just stay at a 5-star hotel type situation. Yeah. And although their gun crimes and criminal activity in general is much lower because they don't live in a police state like we do.
Or have the poverty we have.
Exactly.
Yes.
You know, so.
Yeah. And I think a perfect case to, that supports this, what you're saying, Gus, is like, just in the last 2 years, I mean, last year in particular, I mean, all this, information flowing out there about police killings of especially African Americans, unarmed African Americans, yet it's not stopped, it's not slowed down,
no,
it's accelerated.
Since the Mike Brown incident in Ferguson, police killings against African Americans particularly, and Americans in general, has skyrocketed since that case.
Yes.
So they did this thing about a year since Ferguson, and everybody was asking the questions, has Ferguson gotten better? Has the country gotten better? And the data shows that it hasn't, that police killings have increased, because when you see Democratic stand up and counter hegemonic resistance, you have to repress it. That's neoliberalization. Repress the Democratic state.
Yes.
And that's what you have happening. The more that we resist and the more we rebel, the more they're going to repress us.
But that reaches a certain saturation point after
it
a while.
It is. It's going to reach the
eventually
point. Because after a while, yeah, the consciousness becomes raised because we are in this space. We are in the space of this process of becoming more conscious as we fight the system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you're going to see happening, and it's really getting to this point now where everything is becoming international. Like, people are talking about police violence in America more than they ever have in history.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Okay, well, Bob, you had another story, I know. Did you want to save that, or do you have another one, or?
Well, I was going to do a story kind of related to the Katrina thing.
Well, let's jump into the Katrina thing. You had something, can I go back to Gus? He might have a good intro, and then we can bring yours in. How's
sure.
That? Okay.
Well, my thing is it's going to be kind of detailed, because I'm going to do the history of it, and also an analysis of what we talked about with the federal government. And I have a couple of, I'm actually going to put it into context of more neoliberal capitalist racist type stuff. So I might want to save mine till later, because it's going to be a little lengthy.
Well, we got, about 12, 13 minutes. Would that be enough time?
Oh, that's more than enough time.
Okay.
Cool. We can start now?
Okay.
Okay, great. So like we were talking about before, this is the, on the day, the 10th anniversary of the Hurricane Katrina, which I still argue was one of the grossest ways of human rights violations in the country's history. Because like Dave said earlier, there are things that could have been put in place to stop this from getting to the point that it did, but it was not. So let me actually go back first to the day it happened, and then talk about the implications of what the state did and why this is an issue to this day. So Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast on August 29th, 2005, wreaking destruction from Central Florida to Texas. The greatest number of deaths was in New Orleans, where the levees broke and 80% of the city was flooded. But this level of destruction wasn't only or even mainly the result of the power of the storm itself. The worst aspects of Katrina were man-made. For starters, the federal government failed New Orleans before the storm even hit. New Orleans had been evacuated for Hurricane Ivan the previous year. It was also known well before Katrina, this is very critical, y'all, well before Katrina, that the city's levee system wouldn't survive a more severe storm. The obvious priority in any competent, rational, or equal system would have been to prepare for the inevitable with vast new spending on infrastructure. That's the most rational thing you could have done after Ivan the year before. But this is what happened. Despite the unparalleled foreknowledge that this was the single biggest disaster scenario and should have been the absolute priority of the so-called Department of Homeland Security, the Republicans, with little Democratic opposition, because like I said, they're both the same group at this point, have cut back spending on levee improvement in New Orleans, designed to help protect the city from a storm that large. At this very same time, of course, they were spending money to fortify the border with Mexico. So you had this obscenity of undersized and sinking levees in New Orleans and the gigantic triple wall between San Diego and Tijuana. I'm sure there are a lot of folks in New Orleans who wish they had a wall that big. Seriously.
Really?
This is asinine and ridiculous how horrible and this destruction happened because of government, interference. So why did no government entity, city, state, or federal prepare for a nightmare that was entirely predictable? You all know where I'm going with this as I bring in my analysis, race and class. New Orleans was and is one of the most famous cities in the world and a magnet for tourism. But before Katrina and the massive dislocation of the population, it was also one of the poorest cities in the U.S. And let's put this in comparison to what happened in the Baltimore Rebellion of this year. It was the sixth poorest city, and that's what the people were responding to. Remember, we have to put this in the aspect of the political economy. And I'm going back to New Orleans now, with a population that was 67% African American. The lower Ninth Ward, one of the hardest hit areas of the city, was 99% black, with 36% of residents living under the poverty line. Almost half of the residents living under the poverty line. So the evacuation plan, as Katrina bore down on the Gulf Coast, was to tell people to leave the city. Residents who didn't have a car, and of course many of the poor did not, or were too ill to leave, were told to go to the giant indoor sports stadium, the Superdome. Untold numbers of people didn't make it out or downtown, and so when the levees were breached and water poured into large parts of the city, they were stranded in their homes or on freeway overpasses trying to escape the rising waters, filled with filth and debris, and you also had corpses swimming by you. So evacuees who did reach the Superdome had to wait in line for hours before entering so they could be searched. The supposed refuge from the storm soon became a place of desperation. There was no food and water, and temperatures in the electricity-less stadium rose above 95 degrees. There wasn't enough government assistance to provide for the sick and the dying, but when it came to protecting the private property, let's go back to political economy, protect and serve, protect the rich, serve protects private property. It was all hands on deck. Quickly, stories of criminals on the rampage became the news of the day. In order to rationalize the savage treatment of black people during Katrina, you had mass media, you had police, and you had the mayor of New Orleans putting all this stuff out there about controlling the criminal element of Katrina, these looters going around doing these horrible things, to cover up the fact that what they were doing was protecting private property and not caring about the lives of these people. So like any war zone, hired mercenaries stalked New Orleans after the storm. As independent journalist Jeremy Shahil reported at the time, operatives of the Blackwater Security Company were hired to be an occupying force. So we're talking martial law here, people. Martial law, just as they were in Iraq. Heavily armed soldiers of this private army patrolled the streets of New Orleans with automatic weapons at ready. And there was another side to Katrina, one that almost never made the mainstream news, but was confined to alternative media like Socialist Worker and other groups that don't get the same press as CNN and MSNBC. This is huge. Ordinary people filled in where the government refused to, as community groups and individuals organized their own relief system. This is what we do in history, y'all. When our communities are in crisis, we organize together and we support one another. That is the nature of the human. We don't do individual competitive stuff as capitalism teaches us. We do things together as a community. And that's what happened in New Orleans when the state turned their back on us, the federal government turned their back on us. We formed organization systems and we made our own relief system. Malik Rahim, a former member of the Black Panther Party, helped organize the Common Ground Collective to aid people after the storm. As he and others tried to provide food and water to those who needed it, they faced systematic harassment from law enforcement. So just to kind of finish this off and conclude in what this means in the context of going on forward, across the Gulf Coast region, estimated 2,000 people were killed as a result of Katrina and at least 500,000 displaced. Evacuees were put on buses and planes to places as far as Utah, almost like a Trail of Tears type situation. Often not knowing where they were headed, much less what they would find when they got there. With no money, no place to live, no family or friends, the poor and working class New Orleans were scattered to four winds to fend for themselves. And one of my favorite things that a lot of people always forget about, the president's mother at the time, Barbara Bush, after touring a Houston relocation site, said it was all working out for the best though. So many of the people in the arena here, you know, were underprivileged anyway. So this is working very well for them. We're helping them. They don't know any better. This uplift ideology that these politicians and these elite continue to preach to people is the most ridiculous thing ever, because the only thing that made Katrina salvageable for the people there was that they built community and kinship networks to survive such a horrible situation. When the federal government and the local and state governments failed them, they banded together. And there are a lot more ramifications for this moving forward, in that when you look at the political economy of a lot of parts of this country, in areas like Baltimore or areas like New Orleans, where poverty is really high amongst African-American people, you have situations like this where the federal government historically has turned their back on situations, especially if it's a natural disaster. It costs too much money to fix those areas up since they don't care about the people, but we will fix it if it happens for people who have money. So we really need to think about this, these 10 years, and what has really changed in terms of the distribution of wealth, the communities that we have in this country, and where can we go forward, and how can we use Katrina as a way to teach people that you can have resistance movements against the federal government forgetting about you. You can build your community and you can work together. And that's a very powerful situation.
Indeed. You know, and the thing is, I think what people really need to understand here is that a couple years earlier, there was a huge hurricane in Florida, on the Atlantic coast. Whole different scenario about how that was handled.
Yes.
I mean, the Red Cross came and set up in advance. The National Guard came in. People were evacuated. There was nice, comfortable centers to go to for people in advance. And on top of that, the insurance companies settled with the people before they got insurance settlements were basically, you know, made sure that they were well taken care of. Of course, those were predominantly upper middle class and white areas in Florida. And also to keep in remember this is that Katrina, before it hit New Orleans, hit Cuba really hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know how many people died in Cuba? One person died in Cuba.
Exactly.
What happened in Cuba was the Cuban military mobilized not to basically control and shoot people in the streets or
yes.
whatever that. They brought in amphibious vehicles and took everybody out of harm's way.
Exactly.
One person died, only one, and that was in a very remote rural area.
Yep.
It was probably an accident.
It was. Yeah. It was. They moved everybody out, and they did it so fast.
Yes.
That it was that the Katrina had no chance to really damage Cuban population. I mean, as soon as they heard, they were there.
Yes.
So it's like, again, we have to really think about this, and we have to ask the difficult questions that a lot of Americans don't want to talk about, that this was a racist and a classist situation of exploitation, and just, we don't care about these people, let them go.
Yeah. Simple. And also, both Cuba and Venezuela and offered to send hospital ships with doctors, nurses, yeah. supplies. The Bush administration threatened to blow them out of the water with the U.S. Navy if they came within the, 12-mile limit or whatever.
Yeah.
This was suppressed by the corporate media, but this leaked out in the alternative media big time,
Yes.
But here's the real important thing. Naomi Klein, who you referenced, I believe, wrote a book called Shock Doctrine, in which she documents how, they use this disaster, mm-hmm. the capitalist class, mm-hmm. to basically push through their neoliberal agenda.
Of course.
Everything from gentrification mm-hmm. to privatizing New Orleans public schools to make them charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
These people you talked about who were bussed away weren't allowed to come back to their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And basically this was a big, you know, and they brought in undocumented workers to do some of the relief work that President Bush at that time suspended prevailing wage laws.
Mm-hmm.
These workers came in, were only being paid federal minimum wage. Most of them didn't even get paid for their work.
Yeah.
These contractors were allowed to come in with no bid contracts. And speaking of Blackwater patrolling the streets, we have a young woman here in town in Urbana, Elizabeth Simpson, who was down there doing solidarity work, and she confronted some of these Blackwater thugs in the streets mm-hmm. and basically challenged their authority. And this one, and she's only about, 5'5" or
yeah.
so, 120
yeah.
pounds, and this Blackwater thug put an M16 in her face when she challenged his authority and says, "This is all the law and authority I need. You get off the street, or I swear to God, I'll put a slug in your head."
Yeah.
You know.
I've heard, yeah.
These people are thugs. They're murderers. They're professional hired murderers. I mean, this is documented about what they did in Iraq, you know.
Exactly.
And let's not forget, where was the Louisiana National Guard when all this was going on?
In Iraq. Yeah.
In Iraq.
You know. So I mean, and you know, this is just some of the things, you know. And one thing I want to get in here real quick, and this comes from a blog, about a guy, who I know lives out in Oakland, California, who actually went down to New Orleans, and he was talking about this week. And you know, can you believe that Obama is going to New Orleans, and that George Bush is actually going to show his face there?
Really?
Yes. George Bush is going to go down there for the 10th anniversary. And this guy writes about this. He says, remember that idiot Bush, when that Bush, idiot Bush was in charge? The horse trainer he'd put in as head of FEMA, at least 1,800 people died, tens of thousands of people, you know, lost their homes, and, you know, and had the nerve, this idiot Bush saying that thousands of people who had to go to the sports stadium with insufficient toilets, bathrooms, food supplies, et cetera, probably living better than they had been in their own homes. Mm-hmm. Now we have Obama and a bunch of wimp Democrats heading down to New Orleans, and are they gonna condemn Bush as he should be condemned? Don't hold your breath. One of the top Democrats even said that Bush had done a good job. And Obama, he refuses to stand up to racism in this society and the police killings of young black men. Do you think he's going to say anything? Obama's no idiot. He's extremely conscious, leading member of the U.S. ruling class. Above all, the ruling class live by the following rule. Do not rock the capitalist boat. Yes, take the odd snipe poke at each other. But when it comes to the big issues, do not rock the boat. And also, when it comes to Democrats versus Republicans, do not do anything that will make it impossible for the other to rule at some point.
Yeah, that's an
interesting insight there.
Yeah, that's a poignant point. You know, I've been a very harsh critic of the president in that he refuses to address racism as anti-black racism. He talks about communities of color, and he does this very homogenized thing when he talks about when somebody is killed or something. He never has put it in context of black, anti-black racism against black people in this country.
Yes, this will be continued. So, hold on, folks. We'll be right back, and we're going to take our caller. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Chris Crane.
Hi, Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. This is David Johnson, World Labor Hour, talking to Chris Crane. And Chris, where are you calling in from?
I'm calling in from Boston, Massachusetts.
Okay. Now, the reason I wanted to have you call in today was, first of all, why don't you tell your listeners a little bit about what you've been doing in recent years?
Sure. So I've worked for about 15 years on the issue of ending cannabis prohibition, primarily as a policy advocate out of Washington, D.C. I ran a nonprofit organization and was the associate director of another normal and Students for Sensible Drug Policy. And for the past 5 years, I've been the managing partner of a company called Forefront Advisors, and we work with clients around the country, help them open up very high-end, professionally run medical cannabis dispensaries.
Okay, well, that's quite interesting. Now, you know, I got this press release, I guess, from your press agent or whatever, and what really intrigued me is this is something that I've been hearing people kind of talking about, wondering for some time now, that since, like, states like Colorado and Washington have legalized cannabis, how is this affecting, like, say, DUI laws, workplace drug testing, and that sort of thing?
Well, it depends on the law that's been adopted. I mean, every legalization law that's been put in place still has provisions for driving under the influence. So it's never okay for somebody to use cannabis and then get behind the wheel of a car. That's prohibited in every state. The test for it is slightly different in terms of the cutoff. We don't have a unified standard yet. The way that we do for blood alcohol content.
Okay, that was kind of where I was going to on that, because believe it or not, you probably aware of this, but here in Illinois, if you have even a trace amount of cannabinoids in your system, going back as far as 3 weeks, they consider that driving under the influence.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, and a lot of states have laws like that, and those are basically called per se laws. Essentially, they're testing whether you have any nanograms in your blood or urine stream. If it's a urine stream test, then it really can go back. In some cases, it actually go back more than 3 weeks. Depends on how frequently the person consumes and their age and their percentage of body fat. Because cannabis is, as opposed to other drugs, cannabis is fat soluble, so it's stored in the lipid fat cells. It's inert metabolites, though, that they're testing. So you're right. I mean, you can still test positive because your body gradually secretes the inert metabolites over the course of weeks. as opposed to if somebody were to use cocaine or basically any other drug, which are water soluble, that it would be really hard to test positive within 2 days after using drugs.
Okay, but in the states that have legal, even I guess it's probably medical marijuana states as well, which is Illinois is starting to phasing into it as we speak.
Correct.
But in the states that actually have total legalization of recreational use, there has been defined. Defined thresholds to where they consider this, too much to drive safely. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, that's correct. The standard is a some nanogram content of THC metabolites in the bloodstream. That's a more accurate way to test whether somebody is impaired than the urine stream because it's not in the blood for all that long. It's not 100% accurate, but, frankly, neither are breathalyzers. It's okay. The bigger issue with blood testing, and this is something that we're going to need to get beyond eventually, is it's pretty invasive. It's a lot more invasive than blowing into a breathalyzer. You actually have to, do that in a sanitary environment, get a needle in the arm. It's a much more invasive procedure. So there are some tests underway on other products where they can potentially test cannabinoids in your saliva that may be a little bit more accurate. Towards testing impairment and quite less invasive than a blood test, and those will come down the road. And this is something where I think everybody agrees. Those of us who think that marijuana prohibition has been a giant failure agree that people should not be driving under the influence, and that we need some sort of standard. And we have we have something now. It's in place in all states, and this is only going to get better as this becomes more and more normal part of society.
Okay, now how has this affected drug place work testing in states like Colorado and Washington? I mean, to me, that would seem kind of a bit of a paradox in a way that if it's legal, the companies would still be testing or requiring their employees to test. I mean, unless it's an on-site sobriety test. I'm talking about those tests that see what they've been doing off the job site, weeks prior.
Well, that's right, and that's going to differ from state to state. So every state that adopted legalization has a slightly different standard on this. In most cases, and certainly in Colorado, the employers are prohibited from essentially discriminating against employees who may use cannabis in their own time.
Mm-hmm.
So what we see is most employers are taking cannabis out of their testing. I mean, you could test somebody for alcohol. And essentially it would tell you whether they've used alcohol in their off time, if they've done it, the night or so before, and just employers just generally don't do it because it's not really relevant, unless somebody's coming to work drunk, in which case there's signs of impairment if somebody's coming impaired. And I think we're moving towards more of that in cannabis. It's becoming less a matter of whether cannabis is in your urine stream, which as we already discussed is a really bad way to test impairment, and more whether somebody seems to be impaired. So it is different. I mean, in some states, employers are still allowed to drug test and are still allowed to discipline employees who come up positive for marijuana on a drug test. In other states, they wouldn't be allowed to do that unless they're in a safety-sensitive position.
Okay.
So they're a bus driver or a pilot pilots would get tested because they're FAA, that's federal, but a bus driver, a train driver, a forklift operator, those kind of safety-sensitive positions. May still be subject to drug testing.
Okay. So those are kind of some of the main questions I've asked that I know a lot of working people have been, kind of been pondering about that I've just heard in casual conversations here and there. Now that I've asked those, I'm going to give you just kind of open time here to what would you like our listeners to know about the kind of the work you're doing and what you think might be coming here in the near future?
Well, I think that folks who are interested in this should be paying really close attention to the 2016 election. This is an issue where the majority of Americans now agree in every poll that's taken that marijuana prohibition is a failure, and we need to move towards a system of taxing and regulating marijuana and treating it similarly to alcohol. I think we all, virtually everybody recognizes, or certainly a majority of Americans recognize, that marijuana is certainly no more dangerous than alcohol. And there's no rational justification for treating it as if it's a more dangerous substance. It needs to be brought into the mainstream, regulated, controlled, and taxed. And I think in the 2016 election, we're going to see initiatives to do just that on the ballot in at least five states. Those will include California, Arizona, Nevada, Massachusetts, and Maine. And there's a handful of other states that might also do it. My guess is that that those may all pass. Some will be closer than others. If folks are interested, we'd definitely suggest they check out the Marijuana Policy Project, the Drug Policy Alliance, to to see what's going on or to get involved, see how they can get involved and support these efforts. Because if we can effectively end prohibition and replace it with sensible regulation and taxation in, you know, 5 states or more in 2016, then I think we start to see the end of federal marijuana prohibition come about a lot more quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course that'll definitely empty the jails and prisons considerably as well.
Well, we would certainly hope so. I mean, unfortunately, most of these laws are not retroactive.
Oh, they're not retroactive. So people
generally, they're not.
Wow.
So people who are currently serving sentences under the existing laws would generally not be impacted by these policies. It's a shame. It's something that unfortunately it doesn't pull as well, and putting that into an initiative might be the difference between an initiative passing and failing. So it's unfortunately the kind of thing where the political calculus has been, we've got to legalize cannabis from here forward. Once it's legal, if there are still people sitting in jail for it, as this becomes a more accepted part of society and people realize that this is something that we can handle through regulation rather than through prohibition, it's going to become increasingly impossible to justify keeping people in cages for an offense that is now legal, regulated, and there's a legitimate professional industry that sprung up around it. So I think in the ensuing years, we'll start to see some real efforts to have these laws apply retroactively to release people from prison and expunge records of folks who've gotten caught up in marijuana prohibition arrests in the past.
Okay. Well, listen, Chris, we're about ready to run out of time here. So before you go, though, any last words? And at the very last, any kind of, website or other contact info, people can find out more information from you.
Sure. So obviously, we talked most about policy on this call. But as I mentioned, my company, Forefront Advisors and Forefront Ventures, we work to help professionalize the cannabis industry. It's very important that we're going to make this move away from prohibition and into a regulated market, that it be done in a way that is highly professional and that really people can be proud of and look to it as a model industry. So if folks are interested in finding out more about that or potentially getting involved, they can check us out at forefrontventures.com. It's the numeral 4ventures.com, and can see all about what we're doing. We got a great daily newsletter, so if anyone's interested in getting it's just simply a list of headlines of marijuana-related news organized by national and by state, so real easy digest every morning of the news out there, and you can sign up for that at forefrontpublishing.org. That's again numeral 4frontpublishing.org.
Okay, Chris, well, thank you so much for calling in.
Absolutely, thanks for having me.
Okay, take care.
Tell me forgive. They tell me forgive. Ain't nobody charge but a murder is yet. Half the story ain't never been told. All these drowned victims full of bullet holes.
Okay, we're back. That was Dr. John again. That song was entitled "Say What," and
that's a great song.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. That's off his album, "The City That Care Forgot," and it's Dr. John and the Lower Ninth of the Lower 9/11. Okay, "City That Care Forgot," and we play that every year, Katrina, because he's got three really good songs. There's one more still that we're going to play towards the end of the show. And but I mean, man, he doesn't cut any punches. I mean, the story is only not half. has been told, all these drowning victims, filled with bullet holes. I mean, that's another aspect of the story we didn't even touch on, which if we got time, I'd like to touch on that.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. So, okay, Angela. So, I guess, you remember Hurricane Katrina. What, when that was going down, what were some of your thoughts? I mean, I know maybe at first, you know, just a little information was coming out, and then of course we get more information as time goes on, but just kind of what your general thoughts are, or were, and now are now, you know?
Well, first of all, it was unbelievable. Like, wow. I mean, but, my take on it is, especially, I mean, if you want to even throw the race in there, is that Black people know how to survive through anything. So, you know, this is why I believe that they didn't have the, you know, all these different people in helping or whatever, because Black people are gonna figure out a way to eat. They're gonna figure out a way to build. I mean, we are very talented people, you know? So, you know, that my take on it is that it could have been done better. And I mean, I feel like it was unfair for them because, I mean, why will one place get this certain amount of, you know, you get this, but we don't get that. But, you know, it was a Black thing, I believe. You know, it's all about race and, okay, they're under the poverty level anyway. So, you know.
Okay. Yeah. You know, interesting little side note on that. My wife's ex brother-in-law, career military guy. He's in his 80s now. When this happened with, and hardcore Republican, a racist, okay, this thing that happened to Katrina even touched his cold, dark heart. Mm. I remember my wife was talking to his daughter, my wife's niece, and how she was quoting her father, who, like I said, career military guy, extreme right-wing Republican, a racist, okay, saying that he could not believe what was happening, that these people may be, you know, he used the N-word, but gosh darn it, they're American citizens. And I, as a military veteran, have transported men and equipment all over the world, and there is no excuse why. I mean, this even touched him.
But see, that's the problem. That's the problem with the way people are talking about this. The guy said, hey, these are American citizens. They are not American citizens to the people that were exacerbating this issue.
Indeed.
They are fodder. They are cannon fodder to be pushed away for a new development or a new system to be put in place that further develops their property and their capital. That's what it's all about. They are not citizens. That's why they could do these things. They don't see us in that same light. We have to make sure we delineate that.
Yes. And so what that says a lot about the state of their soul, if you think about
exactly.
it. You know,
it's not that they were humans that the person said this. I can't believe they're American citizens.
Yes.
So is it right then if it happens to people who aren't in America?
That's the kind of
logic and talk and rhetoric, that I really, really dislike. I can't stand when people say that they're citizens first and humans second.
I understand.
That's ridiculous.
This was, I'm just quoting from his perspective.
I'm just talking about those,
but this even touched someone like him. You know, that's what I'm getting at, is that this was such a, a tragedy. I can't find words for it. I mean, it's, you know, and as we said, you know, this was something that was just allowed to happen, and that they took advantage of, you know, to try to, push through their economic agenda and stuff. And I mean, and this really revealed the extent of, not just, I mean, classism for sure, but particular racism in particular. And you know, we hadn't even talked about yet about those vigilante mobs. Let's go back to the looters. Remember, they were saying that was a big concern, right? And remember those stories coming out about all the rapes and murders in the Superdomes. None of those were true. All lies. Mm-hmm. The only murders and looting that was going on, other than people trying to break into a store to get water to live or some canned foods,
exactly.
And the store was already damaged, it's going to collect its insurance money anyway if you're really that concerned about property.
Exactly.
You know, the real looters and murderers were the local police.
Yeah.
The police, not every single policeman in the New Orleans Police Department, but a lot of them, as soon as that storm hit and everything broke down, there was documentation of them going to Best Buy stores and cleaning out electronics, even going to car dealerships and stealing cars.
Exactly.
You know? Then there was all these that police shootings and murders actually of unarmed black people. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just like they went on a rampage.
Yeah.
And then there were these armed vigilante groups that were going around. There was some of them that have gotten on film that basically bragging about it. And then there was the incident where these people were trying to get across the bridge to Algiers, and the Algiers Police Department opened fire on these people, killing, I think, about a half a dozen or so. Mm-hmm. And by the way, after Bush left office and Obama came in, I was happy to see that his Justice Department under Eric Holder went after these cops. But guess what? None of them have been convicted.
None of them. Yeah.
None of them.
Marshall.
Larry None of them.
Marshall
they went through the. They went through the. They went through the motions. Went through. You know, kind of put on a show. You know, had them in court, but none of them to this day have been convicted or gone to jail. For I mean, eyewitness accounts of police murders of unarmed people.
Nobody cares.
Yeah.
Especially if it didn't make it to CNN or NBC.
Well, you know, that's another good thing. I remember when this was going on about Fox News, the worst of the worst out there, right? And the reporters on the ground out down there saying, that reporting something, and then they're talking heads back in, you know, New York City saying, no, you mean this and that, you know, trying to spin it. And they go, no, Charles, I'm telling you, that's not how it is. These people are, you know, I mean, it was incredible. A rank and file revolt of news reporters at Fox News. I mean, I'll tell you what, this, when I saw this, I knew the Bush administration was done for. I mean, you know, it was really done for. But you know, unfortunately we got rid of that moron, but then we got somebody that wasn't much different. You know, if you think about it, the same policies have continued.
Exact same policies and the same way that he addresses groups, the same way, is very homogenized and very just a lack of concern and care for those people. He'll say something like, well, Trayvon could have been my son and all this stuff. Like, I mean, you know, just that kind of superficial language that really just kind of grabs the heart of the elites. But everybody that's living on the ground, like you say, fighting for water and food, they're like, man, get this mess out of here. This is ridiculous. We're starving. We're hungry. We're being killed. Treat us like humans before you treat us like so-called citizens. Because we're not even in the Constitution.
Yeah, just a real quick promo for my television show, Labor's World View. The Sunday after Labor Day, which will be, when will that be? The 13th, I think it is. I'm going to be showing a film I show every year at this time around Katrina called Trouble the Water, which is a really interesting film. It was made by an African-American couple who stayed behind in the Ninth Ward and took this handheld video footage. Incredible film. It won an award.
Amazing film. Amazing.
You've seen it then.
Yes, okay. I love that. It's but that and When the Levees Broke are the two critical pieces of film for Katrina.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, Bob, you've got a story too that's kind of an interesting angle and more recent development here with the anniversary of Katrina.
Yeah, and this comes from National Nurses United.
Okay.
A great union out there. And
one of my favorites, yes.
Yeah, they talk about a decade after Katrina, the RNs reflect on what we've learned and refuse to learn. And that's what they're talking about. On the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina's destruction along the Gulf Coast, registered nurse volunteers with the Disaster Relief Program, RNRN, which is Registered Nurses Response Network, sent hundreds of RN volunteers to provide disaster relief to the region in the wake of the deadly storm, say that critical lessons which exacerbated the 2005 crisis, global climate change, our lack of national health care system, and failure to invest in public resources and infrastructure still have not been learned. They say nurses from the RNRN project of National Nurses United are back in New Orleans this week to show support for residents of the region and highlight that the problems which existed 10 years ago continue to fester. RNs, some of whom volunteered with the RNRN post-Katrina, will staff a first aid tent and participate in Katrina commemoration events hosted by Gulf South Rising, a coordinated regional movement of people and groups to highlight how the global climate crisis and the rising sea levels that come with it are affecting the Gulf Coast states. So one of the vice presidents with National Nurses United, Melinda Markowitz, says things aren't just the same, they're worse. She says, as nurses, we always want to get to the root cause of illnesses, and Katrina exposed them all. The socioeconomic inequality, the racism, the lack of access to health care, how we've defunded our public infrastructure, and how our dependency on fossil fuels has accelerated climate change. On this anniversary, we are again working to build a movement needed to fix these problems, and that's what they're saying. in many aspects. We haven't learned anything from these lessons, and things are, if not, you know, worse.
I'm sorry. I got to repeat this. I cannot get over that George Bush actually has the friggin' nerve to show up in New Orleans this weekend. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. He's probably looking for his buddy Brownie.
He's done a heck of a job, Brownie. I mean, if this wasn't so tragic, it'd be hilarious, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's beyond belief at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, not even this, I don't remember this, but was there ever some type of apology or some type of response from the Bush administration? I mean, even if it's superficial, did they even try to elicit some type of response
to their failings
in this situation? Okay, because, you know, sometimes when something happens and they'll issue response like, we could have did this better or something like that. You know, they'll do that. So I didn't know the Bush administration had actually did that for this.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, just making sure.
Okay.
Yeah, they're
okay. So Gus, you had something else. We both have something else here.
Exactly.
Okay.
One of the things that we definitely want to talk about too, and one of the things that I kind of left out, but I want to bring in because Dave has a really awesome update on this story, is what happened with the education system as a result of Katrina. Because remember, one of the biggest results and really consequences of why the state and different privateers and capitalists allowed this to happen and actually exacerbated the problems was to it was basically an excuse for redevelopment and profit. So, you know, Katrina was actually like a necessary solution to something they were trying to do anyway. So what happens is with the school system, 10 years after then Governor Kathleen Blanco seized what she called the opportunity of a lifetime and handed the New Orleans public education system over to charter school operators, which Dave is going to talk more about, poor students are still bearing the brunt of this turnaround. Well, actual quote. Well, I'll let you get this call first, but I got a couple quotes.
Hello, Carl. You're on the air.
Yeah, sorry, Gus. This is Bill.
And, oh, hi, Bill.
Hey, Bill. Yeah, I was just going to say that George Bush doesn't have the self-awareness necessary to be embarrassed by anything.
Okay, good point. Good point.
And it's a good show, and keep up the good work.
Okay, we'll see you next Saturday for the 2-hour Labor Day special on the World Labor Hour.
All right, have a good weekend.
All right, bye. Okay.
So what I was saying before is that when Barack Obama became president, you know, his Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, called Katrina the best thing that ever happened to the education system in New Orleans. Yeah. And so what happened is there has been this push of this charter school movement after Katrina, and Dave is going to talk about this a lot, that really came after so many African Americans were just dispossessed from the area. The space no longer was theirs, and privateers moved in and they seized it. So I'm just going to turn it over now, because I think that's something we have to really look at, is how the education system transformed after Katrina.
Yes, and this is from a really recent article in These Times, which is a alternative newspaper published out of Chicago. So this is by Colleen Kimmett, and the title of it is 10 Years After Katrina, New Orleans All Charter School System Has Proven a Failure. It's a lengthy article. Even with my editing down, we probably don't have enough time, but I do want to kind of touch on some of the highlights here. But I'll take one more call here. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, where can I see the film you were talking about?
Yes, it's called Trouble the Water. Yes.
Yes. Where can I see that?
It is on Labor's Worldview TV on Urbana Public Television. It'll be on the Sunday after Labor Day from 4 to 5 p.m. And if you get Comcast, it's Comcast Channel 6. If you don't, you can go online at urbanapublictelevision.org.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Great show.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I forgot to give that information out there. Sorry, folks. Yes, thank you, caller, for calling in. I guess there's just been so much information here. That was a little bit of a lapse there. But no, it's this article by Colleen Kimmett. Basically, it starts out by saying Corrine Harper Royal was pleased to be invited to join a Citizens Committee in 2006 to plan for the future of New Orleans schools, but she soon became disillusioned, convinced that the state didn't really want citizen input. It already had a plan and was simply seeking approval. And anyway, in the beginning of 2012, her son was one of the first students to enroll at Carver Collegiate Academy, a privatized charter school that was funded by public money. And anyway, it's going on to say that Carver is part of New Orleans Recovery School District Initiative, which basically is... you know, basically after Hurricane Katrina, it completely overhauled the city's public schools by putting them on the quote-unquote open market. And 10 years later, cities and states around the country embarked on their own charter school experiments and are watching New Orleans closely. Test scores have improved. However, by other measures, in these times received an advanced copy of research done conducted for the Network for Public Education by the University of Arizona researchers. The study compared charters in Louisiana, the majority of which are New Orleans to Louisiana public schools, controlling for factors like race, ethnicity, poverty, and whether students qualified for special education. On eighth grade reading and math tests, charter school students performed worse than their public school counterparts by an enormous margin, 2 to 3 standard deviations. The research has found that the gap between charter and public school performance in Louisiana was the largest of any state in the country, and that Louisiana's overall scores were the fourth lowest in the nation. And he's quoted here saying, you can say until you're blue in the face that this should be a national model, this privatized charter school system, but this is one of the worst performing districts and one of the worst performing states, said MPE board member Julian Vasquez-Halik, an education professor at California State Sacramento. And the test scores, whether high or low, only a piece of the story. And in this three-month investigation in these times, interviewed teachers, parents, students to find out how they feel about the characterization of public education in New Orleans and how charter schools are informing, performing. So, you know, this goes into, I guess, one charter school, the one where this woman's son was at. I guess the students, 100 of them, actually walked out of the school over their disciplinary problems. I mean, it got so bad. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Jim Hyman.
Yes, Jim, what's on your mind today?
I know we're on a short time. I just wanted to mention another excellent documentary on Katrina, and that's Spike Lee's If God Is Willing and the Creek Don't Rise.
Oh, I've never seen that one. What did you think of it?
I thought it was good.
Okay, Spike Lee's film, it's like If God Is Willing, the Creek Doesn't Rise. Okay, okay. You know, there's another one you reminded me of. It was made about the people that were forced out of New Orleans called Bayou in the Desert, about the ones, the New Orleans residents that were flown out to Utah and kept in a military army base for 2 weeks before they were allowed to even leave, you know. So,
yeah,
it's good. Thank you for calling and letting us know about that.
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing up Blackwater. Democracy Now! Didn't.
Oh, yes, unfortunately. Okay.
Well,
yes, I didn't catch him. Goodbye. Okay, so, yeah, Gus, is this any surprise to us? I mean, especially you being an experienced teacher in the Atlanta school system.
I mean, there's a big push out there right now for the charter school movement. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the thing that they want to do is charter schools are taking it back into 100 years ago where a certain type of student was created to serve a particular purpose, mm-hmm. was to work as a public sector worker. And as you see from the test scores and the lowest performing, I mean, one of the lowest performing places with Louisiana and the charter school system, this is what they're going back to. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's getting to the point now that where education is being repressed in the same manner as race and gender are in this country. Education is being taken away from people, and they're using these mechanisms like Katrina. They're using mechanisms like recessions and other types of things in neoliberalism to do this, to kind of facilitate this repression of education, which is why I argue, and those that have seen my Facebook post, it is a human right, and the only way liberation can ever be achieved is through education. So we have to maintain and fight for education as much as possible in this country.
Yes, but like you mentioned, the right type of education.
The right type of education. Critical thinking education.
Right. Right. Yes. Okay, we'll take another call here real quick. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
I am so sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay, go ahead.
RC, and I just, this is an extremely exciting, really important program. I'm so glad you're doing it. And I just wish to relate one little incident.
Yes, uh-huh.
When I worked at IHOP, and it was here in town, and it was shortly after Katrina had happened, I waited on this man who was doing construction work in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
He was a worker, and I was just talking to him, and I just wish to say that he said at the time that we're cleaning the trash out of New Orleans.
Cleaning the trash out of New Orleans.
He
was referring to the people, not the debris. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was referring to people. And I just wish to say, so it wasn't like that wasn't intentional.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, that's all.
Okay, thank you, caller.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Take care.
That was like the recent Tribune editorial.
Right? Yes, Bob, talk about that a little bit. I just caught a glimpse of that.
Yeah. Well, somebody up there on the editorial board wanted to have a Katrina-like event in Chicago to do the same thing. Clean out the public schools and get all charter schools in there, and they were hoping for some kind of huge disaster to strike Chicago so they could do the same thing. Once again, believing that charter schools are the answers to everything, you know.
This is one of the big, there's a lot of big frauds out there being perpetrated by the ruling class in this country and their corporate media. But I think this is one of the biggest ones, is the whole idea of charter, privatized charter schools as being the savior, of our education system. And in particular, for poor communities, in particular African American communities, you gotta understand something, what the basis of this is that if they totally privatize education in this country, we're going back to a time to where it's going to become to where people aren't only going to be able to go to school who could afford to go to school.
Right.
And they'll take that after, you know, they've already done this to, you know, college education, which which used to be affordable for working people and even poor people. Not anymore. They'll start charging money to go to high schools. Mm-hmm. And then they'll start doing it for middle schools.
Mm-hmm. They're gonna leave.
They've already done this in Honduras and some other countries. And you gotta understand what's behind this. This is a potentially a multi-billion-dollar industry if it's privatized. I mean, they've just kind of made a little bit of an inroad. You got to wonder when some people like Bill Gates and the Walton family of Walmart, when these people get in there and fund these propaganda films like Waiting for Superman.
And what's the other one?
I Won't Back Down.
Oh,
you know? I mean, total lie propaganda.
And the teachers, they ate that mess up. There were teachers
that bought into that?
Yeah, that were showing it to their students.
Are you kidding me?
Oh, but you know, I mean, of course, you know, they identify with that type of mess because that rhetoric of just, you know, this anti-union and anti-workers' rights types, you know, just the most ridiculous films ever. Like you said, they're funded through those capitalists who are going to push that crap repeatedly. There's another one coming out soon, I heard.
Really?
At the end of this year, yeah.
Okay.
Another one of those, you know, the pro-school reform movies.
So-called reform.
Yeah, but you know, reform.
Attack on public schools.
Well, you know, reform can mean either way. Reform can also mean to reform it for the privileged.
Yes, indeed, and that's what it's doing.
Exactly.
This, one thing you gotta understand too about public, privatized charter schools is that they, all of them, will basically not allow unionization. Parents have, there's no recourse for parents. In other words, unlike public schools where you have an elected school board, the term cherry picking and lemon dropping. In other words, they will pick the best students out there and exclude average students and forget about special needs kids.
Right.
Forget about the kids that have, English as a second language, needs and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what though? It's not, I mean, you can go to school and get an education, but if you were brought up in, you know, hard times and areas like that, I mean, you have street knowledge as well.
Yeah.
So, but you have people that go to school, they have all these credentials, but they're not better than the person without the credentials.
Well, of course they're not better.
The person without the credentials can do better than what all of them are doing.
But, you know, the more education somebody has, whether it's practical education, street education, higher education, whatever, the better the person is. And I think, in my opinion, people should not be prevented from having that if they want it, you know.
Well, I agree with that. And I agree with one other thing is that if you like something as far as a job that you want to pick, if you like this, then this is what you should go into.
Because
when you go into a job and that's not really what you want, and it's all about the money, then you're not doing that job right.
Well, that's true.
And let's make sure we talk about this as well, because both of you brought up a very excellent point in this idea that it's not just about them removing students and excluding students, but it's also the shaping of what type of curriculum that they are getting. Because what they're doing in these school systems, they're actually giving them very watered down, basic type things that excludes them from doing any type of critical thinking or any type of teamwork building or you know, some type of group type stuff. And if they do a group activity, it's something that's extremely basic. You know, they wouldn't let us do any real critical thinking type things with these students.
Mm-hmm.
It's test taking and that's it. And again, this is exactly what David said earlier, that if we go back to the time period where only the very few could go to school, the rest of them, whatever type of education they they are allowed to get is only going to be to push buttons and sweep streets to clean up for the rest of the privileged. So we're creating a bigger divide and disparity amongst the poor and rich, and especially African-American and the rich, privileged white class. That is what's happening in this country.
And it goes back to the beginning of time. You know, this is all, everything going on has been going on. Nothing's changed.
Well, that's true, Angela. But you know what? I'd like to think that as time moves on, that we evolve as human beings as opposed to de-evolving. And what I've seen in my lifetime, I'm 58 years old. I graduated high school in 1975. When I graduated high school, we went through some troubled times. I remember growing up watching people getting, you know, dogs sicked on them and beaten by the police down south, you know, in Mississippi, wherever. I saw the Vietnam War live on television. You too, Bob. You're a couple years older than me. Yep. You know, we got rid of a corrupt president by people on the streets. We basically, you know, we achieved at least made some improvements for, you know, people in the South and elsewhere, you know, African Americans and stuff. The CIA, you know, the military industrial complex was back down. It looked like we were finally starting to head somewhere in this country. And then, come 1980, the empire struck back. I mean, basically. And we've been going downhill ever since, regardless if we've had Republican or Democratic presidents, because these Democratic presidents, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, have just, they haven't reversed their predecessors' policies. They've continued them and expanded them.
Yes, they have. Exactly. Yes. I mean, and you just brought up a great point too. America itself has evolved and expanded because now they're using drone planes. And they're using all these other horrible, disgusting weapons of war that were, you know, like the, you know, back in the World War I and World War II where you had the gas and you had the machine guns and stuff. They've now turned this into a complete, like, almost, just fantasy camp for these bloodhounds to go out and just murder people who are not white, rich males. I mean, it's
and doing it with a drone. You got some guy who's an operator in some Air Force base somewhere. He's playing a video game.
Exactly.
He doesn't see the blood. He doesn't see the dismembered bodies of children and women. You know, drones hidden. And why is this for? To protect our freedoms? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? It's to protect the ruling class and the wealthy in this country and worldwide. It's not about helping working people or the poor. Not so one bit. And what I'm saying is human race should be evolving, and at various points in period, you're a historian, Gus, you correct me if I'm wrong, but history's kind of like a, you know, roller coaster.
Of course.
We get some advances, we have some fallbacks, we get some advances, but, you know, I'd like to think the human race is somewhat evolving over time. We're in a downturn right now. Let's face it.
Yeah,
you know?
The repression is there. The repression is there. You know, as much as we are evolving as a consciousness, I mean, we have movements across groups now that are starting to look somewhat like Reconstruction did, where you have multiple races making very similar arguments. They're not getting to the foundation of the problem yet, but they're starting to awaken to the foundation of the problem, which is something that I didn't think I was going to see for another 10 years. So that's the good part of the evolution. But the problem is that the repression is going to continue unless we get to that foundation part. We're going to see more violence, not just here, but overseas, which is incredibly correlated. We have to address these problems and we have to continue to fight together.
Yes.
And that's how we evolve. That's
it. We definitely are. And you know what? Just like Nino said on New Jack City, he said, meanwhile, the rich get richer and the poor don't get nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. You know, that's kind of how our foreign policy is conducted, isn't it? Kind of a gangster diplomacy.
Yeah.
You know,
that's the supreme thuggery. That's the, you know, they like to use that term as a stereotype against African Americans, but there's nothing more thuggish than what the United States government has done since the Monroe Doctrine of 1823.
Yeah. You heard me use the word thug twice in this show as reference to Blackwater mercenaries.
That's exactly what it is.
They are thugs.
It's supreme thuggery. That should be the U.S. textbook name. When you go to high school, the Supreme Thuggery book. That's all it is.
You think of blacks, though, when you hear thugs.
Well,
those aren't the real thugs.
No, of course not.
We don't have the capabilities or the power to do real thuggery.
Oh, yeah. And but we're going to jail.
I could do a whole show on that.
Bob, you got something? Man, we got everybody excited here. Well, I tell you what, this has been a real interesting show. I hope you listeners enjoyed it. And my God, I swear we could go on probably about this with Katrina but I mean, that's why we always do something every year at this time, because Katrina should never be forgotten. And the most important thing is don't let the corporate media and our politicians who are bought off by the wealthy excuse the term, whitewash this. I don't know a better term for it.
But no, that's exactly what
you
it is.
You know, to basically make it out to like, you know, to bury the bad parts and try to say, yeah, it just happened and we did the best we could and we're Americans and we'll move on. It's like, that's nonsense. This has to be remembered for what it was and never forgotten about. So
I got a bunch of public service announcements.
Oh,
there.
Bob, yes, please go ahead real quick.
Yeah, we got a Facebook post today on our Facebook page from a gentleman named Greg Buzel.
Okay.
And he wanted to announce that he's got an audio documentary called We Were Not Ladies, We Were Women. And the audio documentary tells the story of a 1930s labor leader, Agnes Burns Week, and her role in the Illinois Mine War. So the broadcast can be heard on several public radio stations. Now, this is coming up next weekend, Sunday, September 6th. It's going to be on WILL AM 580 in Urbana at 2 o'clock. And then it's going to be on a couple stations out of Springfield and Carbondale then the following Monday. And it's all about, like I say, this woman, Agnes Burns Week. Back in 1933, she got 10,000 women to go into Springfield, Illinois to petition and support their husbands as mine workers.
Mm-hmm.
There was a split from the United Mine Workers of America to form a dissident progressive union, the Progressive Miners of America.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was the leader of that, Agnes Burns Week. So anyway, you can catch that show next Sunday, September 6th at 2 p.m. on WILL AM 580.
Okay.
Also, of course, next Monday, September 7th, is the Labor Day Parade.
Oh, yes.
10 mm-hmm. o'clock at Lincoln Square, heading down Broadway and then east on Washington to Perry Park, where there'll be all kinds of games and inflatables and food and softball games. And
that's
stuff
open
like
to everybody?
That. Open to everybody. Come on out for that. Also happening this Monday at the Iron Post is a benefit for WEFT 90.1 on the FM dial. David Gans is going to be there. It kicks off at 7 o'clock with Gaia Tonic, a local world rock group. And then David Gans, host of the Grateful Dead Hour, is going to be there playing Dead songs, some of his own originals and stuff. $10 at the Iron Post. It is a benefit for WEFT.
Okay.
And, of course, our pledge drive kicks off this week on Tuesday, September 1st.
Yep.
And partway through our pledge drive, WEFT Fest is coming up on Sunday, September 13th, 5 to 10 p.m., pretty much right next door at Mike and Molly's Beer Garden.
Yeah, and out front here on Market Street as well.
Yeah, and we're going to have five different performers there, the Wildwood String Band, Sabine Mulamba, Katie Flynn, Hot Hand Luke in the Sound, and a local blues kid, Kevin Corey, is going to have his band out there. So 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. that Sunday, September 13th.
And that's free too, isn't it?
That's free.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going
to
be all
kinds
of
I used to say to my daughter when she was little, daddy loves free. So, okay. You've been listening to the World Labor Hour, listener supported community radio station, WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Hope you enjoyed the program today. Stay tuned, tune in next week, for our special 2-hour show from 11 to 1 p.m. We're going to be having some, in studio guests, and also, State Representative Carol Ammons will be calling in the show.
Great.
She regrets that she's got to go down to St. Louis to see her brothers, but she was going to come in person, but at least she's going to call in. So tune into that. We're also going to be playing some a lot of music too. So until then, be safe and power to the people. Take care.
Biggest land grave since Columbus started to snatch in his land from the skin. In the 21st century, some men behind closed doors started doing the same thing all over again. Push us all by the land to the Gulf of Mexico. Lord, I want all y'all to know. Without our wetlands, we all created. And I'm gonna tell you, it's Cheney and a Halliburton.